Writings from the Radical Fringe. I decided to start from the perspective of the average consumer of news. People pick up a magazine or newspaper, read the conclusions of the Jesus Seminar, and assume that this represents the mainstream of New Testament scholarship, I said. But is that really the case? No, he said, looking as if he had just bitten into something sour. No, that's not the case. But you're right. People get that impression. He rocked in his chair until he got comfortable enough to tell a story. When Time came out with its first major article on the Jesus Seminar, I happened to be in the process of talking about Christianity with a guy whom I was building a relationship with. He was very skeptical by nature and quite inebriated with New Age ideas. We had a mutual friend who was hospitalized, and when I went to visit him, this other guy was already there reading Time. As I walked into the room, he said to me, "Well, Greg, it looks like the scholars disagree with you." And he threw the magazine at me. Boyd shook his head in both sadness and disbelief. You see, that article gave him the reason to stop taking me seriously. Even though he knew I was a scholar, he interpreted this article as saying that the majority of scholars, at least those who aren't wacko fundamentalists, hold these views. I could empathize with Boyd's story, having heard too many people equate the Jesus Seminar with all scholars. "Do you think that impression is an accident?" I asked. "Well, the Jesus Seminar certainly portrays itself that way. In fact, this is one of its most irritating facets, not just to evangelicals, but to other scholars as well. If you look at their book, The Five Gospels, they give 7 pillars of scholarly wisdom, as if you must follow their methodology if you're going to be a true scholar. But a lot of scholars, from a wide spectrum of backgrounds, would have serious reservations about one or even most of these pillars. And the Jesus Seminar calls its translation of the Bible the Scholar's Version. Well, what does that imply? That other versions aren't scholarly?" He paused for a moment, then cut to the core of the issue. "Here's the truth. The Jesus Seminar represents an extremely small number of radical fringe scholars who are on the far left wing of New Testament thinking. It does not represent mainstream scholarship. And ironically, they have their own brand of fundamentalism. They say they have the right way of doing things, period." He smiled. "In the name of diversity," he added with a chuckle, "they can actually be quite narrow." Discovering the real Jesus. "At least," I said, "the participants in the Jesus Seminar have been very upfront about their goals, haven't they?" "Oh, yes, that's right. They're explicit in saying they want to rescue the Bible from fundamentalism and to free Americans from the naive belief that the Jesus of the Bible is the real Jesus. They say they want a Jesus who's relevant for today. One of them said that the traditional Jesus did not speak to the needs of the ecological crisis, the nuclear crisis, the feminist crisis, so we need a new picture of Jesus. As another one said, we need a new fiction. One of the twists is that they're going directly to the masses instead of to other scholars. They want to take their findings out of the ivory tower and bring them into the marketplace to influence popular opinion. And what they have in mind is a totally new form of Christianity." The idea of a new Jesus, a new faith, a new Christianity was intriguing. "So tell me about this Jesus that people from the Jesus Seminar have discovered. What's he like?"
"Basically, they've discovered what they set out to find. Some think he was a political revolutionary, some a religious fanatic, some a wonder worker, some a feminist, some an egalitarian, some a subversive. There's a lot of diversity," he said. Then he zeroed in on the key issue. "But there is one picture that they all agree with. Jesus, first of all, must be a naturalistic Jesus. In other words, whatever else is said about him, Jesus was a man like you and me. Maybe he was an extraordinary man. Maybe he tapped into our inherent potential as nobody else ever has, but he was not supernatural. So they say Jesus and his early followers didn't see him as God or the Messiah, and they didn't see his death as having any special significance. His crucifixion was unfortunate and untimely, and stories about his resurrection came later as a way of trying to deal with that sad reality."
Giving evidence a fair hearing. I stood and strolled over to his bookshelf as I formulated my next question. "Okay, but you
personally have faith that Jesus was resurrected. And maybe your faith taints your viewpoint too much, I said. The Jesus Seminar paints itself as being on an unbiased quest for truth, as compared with religiously committed people, people like you, who have a theological agenda. Boyd turned in his seat to face me. Ah, but that's not what's really going on, he insisted. The participants of the Jesus Seminar are at least as biased as evangelicals, and I would say more so. They bring a whole set of assumptions to their scholarship, which of course we all do to some degree. Their major assumption, which incidentally is not the product of unbiased scholarly research, is that the Gospels are not even generally reliable. They conclude this at the outset because the Gospels include things that seem historically unlikely, like miracles, walking on water, raising the dead. These things, they say, just don't happen. That's naturalism, which says that for every effect in the natural or physical world, there is a natural cause. Yeah, but isn't that the way people typically live their lives? I asked. Are you saying we should be looking for supernatural explanations behind everything that takes place? Everyone would agree that you don't appeal to supernatural causes if you don't have to, Boyd said. But these scholars go beyond that and say you don't ever have to. They operate under the assumption that everything in history has happened according to their own experiences. And since they've never seen the supernatural, they assume miracles have never occurred in history. Here's what they do. They rule out the possibility of the supernatural from the beginning. And then they say, now, bring on the evidence about Jesus. No wonder they get the results they do. I wanted to turn the tables a bit. All right. Then how would you proceed? I asked. I would grant that you shouldn't appeal to the supernatural until you have to. Yes, first look for a natural explanation. I do that in my own life. A tree falls. Okay, maybe there were termites. Now, could an angel have pushed it over? Well, I wouldn't go to that conclusion until there was definite evidence for it. So I grant that. But what I can't grant is the tremendous presumption that we know enough about the universe to say that God, if there is a God, can never break into our world in a supernatural way. That's a very presumptuous assumption. That's not a presumption based on history. Now you're doing metaphysics. I think there should be a certain amount of humility in the historical investigation to say, you know what? It is just possible that Jesus Christ did rise from the dead. It's just possible that his disciples actually saw what the Gospels say they saw. And if there's no other way of accounting adequately for the evidence, let's investigate that possibility. That, I think, is the only way to give the evidence a fair hearing. Critiquing the criteria. To come up with their conclusion that Jesus never spoke most of the words in the Gospels, members of the Jesus Seminar used their own set of assumptions and criteria. But are these standards reasonable and appropriate, or were they loaded from the outset, like dice that are weighted so they yield the result that was desired all along? There are multiple problems with their assumptions and criteria, Boyd began in analyzing the group's approach. For instance, they assume that the later church put these sayings into the mouth of Jesus, unless they have good evidence to think otherwise. That assumption is rooted in their suspicion of the Gospels, and that comes from their assumption that the supernatural can't occur. Historians usually operate with the burden of proof on the historian to prove falsity or unreliability, since people are generally not compulsive liars. Without that assumption, we'd know very little about ancient history. The Jesus Seminar turns this on its head and says, you've got to affirmatively prove that a saying came from Jesus. Then they come up with questionable criteria to do that. Now, it's okay for scholars to use appropriate criteria in considering whether Jesus said something, but I'm against the idea that if Jesus doesn't meet these criteria, he must not have said it. That kind of negative conclusion can be a problem. Dealing in this theoretical realm was starting to bring more murkiness than clarity for me. I needed some concrete examples so I could follow Boyd's point. Talk about some of the specific criteria they used, I said. One is called double dissimilarity. This means they can believe Jesus said something if it doesn't look like something a rabbi or the later church would say. Otherwise, they assume it got into the Gospels from a Jewish or Christian source. The obvious problem is that Jesus was Jewish, and he founded the Christian church, so it shouldn't be surprising if he sounds Jewish and Christian. Yet they've applied this criterion to reach the negative conclusion that Jesus didn't say a whole lot. Then there's the criterion of multiple attestation, which means we can only be sure Jesus said something if it's found in more than one source. Now, this can be a helpful test in confirming a saying. However, why argue in the other direction? If it's only found in one source, it's not valid. In fact, most of ancient history is based on single sources. Generally, if a source is considered reliable, and I would argue that there are plenty of reasons to believe that the Gospels are reliable, it should be considered credible, even if it can't be confirmed by other sources. Even when Jesus' sayings are found in two or three Gospels, they don't consider this as passing the multiple attestation criterion. If a saying is found in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they consider that only one source because they assume that Matthew and Luke used Mark in writing their Gospels. They're failing to recognize that an increasing number of scholars are expressing serious reservations about the theory that Matthew and Luke used Mark. With this line of thinking, you can see why it's extremely difficult to prove multiple attestation. Boyd started to go on, but I told him he had already made his point. Loaded criteria, like weighted dice, inevitably bring the results that were desired from the beginning. Jesus, the Wonder Worker. One approach taken by naturalistic scholars has been to look for parallels between Jesus and others from ancient history as a way of demonstrating that his claims and deeds were not completely unique. Their goal is to explain away the view that Jesus was one of a kind. How do you respond to this? I asked Boyd. For example, there were ancient rabbis who did exorcisms or prayed for rain, and it came. So some scholars have said Jesus was merely another example of a Jewish wonder worker. Do those parallels hold up? I was about to see Boyd, the debater, in action as he responded point by point to a complex issue without the benefit of notes. I was glad I was taping our conversation. My note-taking would never have kept up with his rapid-fire delivery.
Actually,
the parallels break down quickly when you look more closely, he began, picking up speed as he went. For one thing, the sheer centrality of the supernatural in the life of Jesus has no parallel whatsoever in Jewish history. Second, the radical nature of his miracles distinguishes him. It doesn't just rain when he prays for it. We're talking about blindness, deafness, leprosy, and scoliosis being healed, storms being stopped, bread and fish being multiplied, sons and daughters being raised from the dead. This is beyond any parallels. Third, Jesus' biggest distinctive is how he did miracles on his own authority. He is the one who says, "If I, by the finger of God, cast out demons, then the kingdom of God is among you." He's referring to himself. He says, "I have been anointed to set the captives free." He does give God the Father credit for what he does, but you never find him asking God the Father to do it. He does it in the power of God the Father. And for that, there is just no parallel. This goes right along with the different way Jesus talked about himself. All authority has been given to me. Honor me, even as you honor the Father. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word will not pass away. You don't find rabbis talking like this anywhere.
Having been on the receiving end of that quick burst of arguments, I said with a chuckle,
"So, what's your point?"
Boyd laughed.
"Any parallels with wonder-working rabbis," he said, "are going to be very, very stretched."
Jesus and the amazing Apollonius. I wasn't going to let Boyd's debating skills intimidate me. I decided to raise a more difficult issue. The seemingly stronger parallels between Jesus and an historical figure named Apollonius of Tyana.
"You know the evidence as well as I do," I said to Boyd.
"Here's someone from the first century who was said to have healed people and to have exorcised demons, who may have raised a young girl from the dead and who appeared to some of his followers after he died. People point to that and say, 'Aha! If you're going to admit that the Apollonius story is legendary, why not say the same thing about the Jesus story?'" Boyd was nodding to indicate he was tracking with me.
Yeah. "I'll admit that initially this sounds impressive," he said. When I first heard about Apollonius as a college student, I was really taken aback. But if you do the historical work calmly and objectively, you find that the alleged parallels just don't stand up. I needed specifics, not generalities. "Go ahead," I said. "Do your best to shoot it down." "Okay. Well, first, his biographer, Philostratus, was writing a century and a half after Apollonius lived, whereas the Gospels were written within a generation of Jesus. The closer the proximity to the event, the less chance there is for legendary development, for error, or for memories to get confused. Another thing is that we have four Gospels corroborated with Paul that can be cross-checked to some degree with non-biblical authors like Josephus and others. With Apollonius, we're dealing with one source. Plus, the Gospels pass the standard tests used to assess historical reliability, but we can't say that about the stories of Apollonius. On top of that, Philostratus was commissioned by an empress to write a biography in order to dedicate a temple to Apollonius. She was a follower of Apollonius, so Philostratus would have had a financial motive to embellish the story and give the empress what she wanted. On the other hand, the writers of the Gospel had nothing to gain and much to lose by writing Jesus' story, and they didn't have ulterior motives such as financial gain. Also, the way Philostratus writes is very different than the Gospels. The Gospels have a very confident eyewitness perspective, as if they had a camera there. But Philostratus includes a lot of tentative statements like, it is reported that, or some say this young girl had died, others say she was just ill. To his credit, he backs off and treats stories like stories. And here's a biggie. Philostratus was writing in the early 3rd century in Cappadocia, where Christianity had already been present for quite a while. So any borrowing would have been done by him, not by Christians. You can imagine the followers of Apollonius seeing Christianity as competition and saying, "Oh yeah? Well, Apollonius did the same things Jesus did. Sort of like, my dad can beat up your dad." One final point. I'm willing to admit that Apollonius may have done some amazing things, or at least tricked people into thinking he did, but that doesn't in any way compromise the evidence for Jesus. Even if you grant the evidence for Apollonius, you're still left with having to deal with the evidence for Christ. Jesus and the mystery religions. Okay, I thought to myself, let's give this one more try. A lot of college students are taught that many of the themes seen in the life of Jesus are merely echoes of ancient mystery religions, in which there are stories about gods dying and rising, and rituals of baptism and communion. "What about those parallels?" I asked. "That was a very popular argument at the beginning of the century, but it generally died off because it was so discredited. For one thing, given the timing involved, if you're going to argue for borrowing, it should be from the direction of Christianity to the mystery religions, not vice versa. Also, the mystery religions were do-your-own-thing religions that freely borrowed ideas from various places. However, the Jews carefully guarded their beliefs from outside influences. They saw themselves as a separate people and strongly resisted pagan ideas and rituals. To me, the most interesting potential parallels were the mythological tales of gods dying and rising. Aren't those stories similar to Christian beliefs?" I asked. "Well, it's true that some mystery religions had stories of gods dying and rising. These stories always revolved around the natural life cycle of death and rebirth," Boyd said. "Crops die in the fall and come to life in the spring. People express the wonder of this ongoing phenomenon through mythological stories about gods dying and rising. These stories were always cast in a legendary form. They depicted events that happened once upon a time. Contrast that with the depiction of Jesus Christ in the Gospels. They talk about someone who actually lived several decades earlier, and they name names. Crucified under Pontius Pilate, when Caiaphas was the high priest, and the father of Alexander and Rufus carried his cross, for example. That's concrete historical stuff. It has nothing in common with stories about what supposedly happened once upon a time. And Christianity has nothing to do with life cycles or the harvest. It has to do with a very Jewish belief, which is absent from the mystery religions, about the resurrection of the dead and about life eternal and reconciliation with God. As for the suggestion that the New Testament doctrines of baptism or communion come from mystery religions, that's just nonsense. For one thing, The evidence for these supposed parallels comes after the second century, so any borrowing would have come from Christianity, not the other way around. And when you look carefully, the similarities vanish. For instance, to get to a higher level in the Mithra cult, followers had to stand under a bull while it was slain so they could be bathed in its blood and guts. Then they joined the others in eating the bull. Now, to suggest that Jews would find anything attractive about this and want to model baptism and communion after this barbaric practice is extremely implausible, which is why most scholars don't go for it. Secret Gospels and Talking Crosses. As disorderly and disorganized as his office was, Boyd's mind was sharp and systematized. His analysis of these much-touted parallels left little room for doubt. So I decided to advance to another area that the media often write about, the new discoveries that are often the subject of books by Jesus Seminar participants. There's been a lot written in the popular press about the Gospel of Thomas, Secret Mark, the Cross Gospel, and Q, I said. Have there really been any new discoveries that change the way we should think about Jesus? Boyd sighed in exasperation. No, there are no new discoveries that tell us anything new about Jesus. The Gospel of Thomas was discovered long ago, but it's only now being used to create an alternative Jesus. Some theories about the Gospel of Thomas may be new, but the Gospel itself is not. As for Q, it's not a discovery, but a theory that's been around for 1.5 centuries, which tries to account for the material that Luke and Matthew have in common. What's new is the highly questionable way that left-wing scholars are using their presuppositions to slice this hypothetical Q into various layers of legendary development to back up their preconceived theories. I knew that John Dominic Crossan, perhaps the most influential scholar in the Jesus Seminar, has made some strong claims about a gospel called Secret Mark. In fact, he asserts that Secret Mark may actually be an uncensored version of the Gospel of Mark, containing confidential matters for spiritual insiders. Some have used it to claim that Jesus was actually a magician, or that a number of early Christians practiced homosexuality. This conspiratorial scenario has captured the media's imagination. What proof is there for this? I asked Boyd. His answer came quickly. None, he said. Though he apparently didn't see the need to elaborate, I asked him to explain what he meant.
You see, we don't have Secret Mark, he said. What we have is one scholar who found a quote from Clement of Alexandria from late in the second century that supposedly comes from this gospel. And now, mysteriously, even that is gone, disappeared. We don't have it. We don't have a quote from it. And even if we did have a quote from it, we don't have any reason to think that it has given us any valid information about the historical Jesus or what early Christians thought about him. On top of that, we already know that Clement had a track record of being very gullible in accepting spurious writings. So, Secret Mark is a non-existent work cited by a now non-existent text by a late second-century writer who's known for being naive about these things. The vast majority of scholars don't give this any credibility. Unfortunately, those who do get a lot of press because the media loves the sensational.
Crossan also gives credence to what he calls the cross gospel. Does that fare any better? I asked.
No. Most scholars don't give it credibility because it includes such outlandishly legendary material. For instance, Jesus comes out of his tomb and he's huge! He goes up beyond the sky, and the cross comes out of the tomb and actually talks. Obviously, the much more sober Gospels are more reliable than anything found in this account. It fits better with later apocryphal writings. In fact, it's dependent on biblical material, so it should be dated later.
Unlike the overwhelming majority of biblical experts, the Jesus Seminar has accorded extremely high status to the Gospel of Thomas, elevating it to a place alongside the four traditional Gospels. In Chapter 3, Dr. Bruce Metzger strongly criticized that position as being unwarranted. I asked Boyd for his opinion. Why shouldn't Thomas be given that kind of honor?
Everyone concedes that this Gospel has been significantly influenced by Gnosticism
which was a religious movement in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries that supposedly had secret insights, knowledge, or revelations that would allow people to know the key to the universe. Salvation was by what you knew. Gnosis is Greek for know, he said. So most scholars date the Gospel of Thomas to the mid-2nd century, in which it fits well into the cultural milieu. Let me give you an example. Jesus is quoted as saying, "Every woman who will make herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven." That contradicts the attitude that we know Jesus had toward women, but it fits well with the Gnostic mindset. However, the Jesus Seminar has arbitrarily latched onto certain passages of the Gospel of Thomas and has argued that these passages represent an early strand of tradition about Jesus, even earlier than the canonical Gospels. Because none of these passages include Jesus making exalted claims for himself or doing supernatural feats, they argue that the earliest view of Jesus was that he was only a great teacher. But the whole line of reasoning is circular. The only reason for thinking these passages in Thomas are early in the first place is because they contain a view of Jesus that these scholars already believed was the original Jesus. In truth, there's no good reason for preferring the 2nd century Gospel of Thomas over the 1st century Gospels of the New Testament. History versus faith. The Jesus of history and the Jesus of faith. The Jesus Seminar believes there's a big gulf between the two. In its view, the historical Jesus was a bright, witty, countercultural man who never claimed to be the Son of God, while the Jesus of faith is a cluster of feel-good ideas that help people live right but are ultimately based on wishful thinking. There's not just a gulf between the Jesus of history and the Jesus of faith, Boyd said as I brought up this subject. If you discredit everything that says Jesus is divine and reconciles people with God, there's an outright contradiction between the two. Generally speaking, they define the Jesus of faith this way. There are religious symbols that are quite meaningful to people. The symbol of Jesus being divine, of the cross, of self-sacrificial love, of the resurrection. Even though people don't really believe that those things actually happened, they nevertheless can inspire people to live a good life, to overcome existential angst, to realize new potentialities, to resurrect hope in the midst of despair, blah, blah, blah. He shrugged his shoulders. Sorry, I've heard this stuff so much it comes out of my ears. So, these liberals say historical research can't possibly discover the Jesus of faith because the Jesus of faith is not rooted in history. He's merely a symbol, Boyd continued. But listen, Jesus is not a symbol of anything unless he's rooted in history. The Nicene Creed doesn't say, "We wish these things were true." It says, "Jesus Christ was crucified under Pontius Pilate, and the third day he rose again from the dead," and it goes on from there. The theological truth is based on historical truth. That's the way the New Testament talks. Look at the sermon of Peter in the 2nd chapter of Acts. He stands up and says, "You guys are a witness of these things. They weren't done in secret. David's tomb is still with us, but God has raised Jesus from the dead. Therefore, we proclaim him to be the Son of God." Take away miracles, and you take away the resurrection, and then you've got nothing to proclaim. Paul said that if Jesus wasn't raised from the dead, our faith is futile. It's useless. It's empty. Boyd stopped for a moment. His voice dropped a notch from preaching mode to an intense expression of personal conviction. "I don't want to base my life on a symbol," he said resolutely. "I want reality. And the Christian faith has always been rooted in reality. What's not rooted in reality is the faith of liberal scholars. They're the ones who are following a pipe dream, but Christianity is not a pipe dream." Combining History and Faith. We had spent a lot of time talking about the Jesus of the Jesus Seminar, a symbolic Jesus, but one who's impotent to offer the world anything except the illusion of hope. But before we left, I wanted to hear about the Jesus of Gregory Boyd. I needed to know whether the Jesus he researches and writes scholarly books about as a theology professor is the same Jesus he preaches about in his church on Sunday mornings. "Let me get this straight," I said. "Your Jesus, the Jesus you relate to, is both a Jesus of history and a Jesus of faith?" Boyd clenched his fist for emphasis, as if I had just scored a touchdown.
"Yes! That's it exactly, Lee!" he exclaimed,
moving to the very edge of his chair
he spelled out precisely what his scholarship and his heart have brought him to believe.
It's like this. If you love a person, your love goes beyond the facts of that person, but it's rooted in the facts about that person. For example, you love your wife because she's gorgeous, she's nice, she's sweet, she's kind. All these things are facts about your wife, and therefore you love her. But your love goes beyond that. You can know all these things about your wife and not be in love with her and put your trust in her, but you do. So the decision goes beyond the evidence, yet it is there also on the basis of the evidence. So it is with falling in love with Jesus. To have a relationship with Jesus Christ goes beyond just knowing the historical facts about him, yet it's rooted in the historical facts about him. I believe in Jesus on the basis of the historical evidence, but my relationship with Jesus goes way beyond the evidence. I have to put my trust in him and walk with him on a daily basis. I interrupted to say, "Yes, but will you acknowledge that Christianity makes some claims about Jesus that are just plain hard to believe?" "Yes, of course I do," he replied. "That's why I'm glad we have such incredibly strong evidence to show us they're true. For me, it comes down to this. There's no competition. The evidence for Jesus being who the disciples said he was, for having done the miracles that he did, for rising from the dead, for making the claims that he did, is just light years beyond my reasons for thinking that the left-wing scholarship of the Jesus Seminar is correct. What do these scholars have? Well, there's a brief allusion to a lost secret gospel in a late second century letter that has unfortunately only been seen by one person and has now itself been lost. There's a third century account of the crucifixion and resurrection that stars a talking cross and that less than a handful of scholars thinks predates the gospels. There's a second century Gnostic document, parts of which some scholars now want to date early to back up their own preconceptions. And there is a hypothetical document built on shaky assumptions that's being sliced thinner and thinner by using circular reasoning. Boyd flopped back in his chair. "Now, I'm sorry. I don't buy it. It's far more reasonable to put my trust in the Gospels, which pass the tests of historical scrutiny with flying colors, than to put my hope in what the Jesus Seminar is saying." A chorus of criticism. Back at my motel, I mentally played back my interview with Boyd. I felt the same way he did. If the Jesus of faith is not also the Jesus of history, he's powerless and he's meaningless. Unless he's rooted in reality, unless he established his divinity by rising from the dead, he's just a feel-good symbol who's as irrelevant as Santa Claus. But there's good evidence that he's more than that. I had already heard well-supported eyewitness, documentary, corroborating, and scientific evidence supporting the New Testament claim that he is God incarnate. And I was getting ready to hit the road again to dig out even more historical material about his character and resurrection. Meanwhile, Greg Boyd isn't a lone voice crying out against the Jesus Seminar. He's a part of a growing crescendo of criticism coming not just from prominent conservative evangelicals, but also from other well-respected scholars representing a wide variety of theological backgrounds. An example was as close as my motel's nightstand, where I reached over to pick up a book called The Real Jesus, which I had recently purchased. Its author is Dr. Luke Timothy Johnson, the highly regarded professor of New Testament and Christian origins at the Candler School of Theology of Emory University. Johnson is a Roman Catholic who was a Benedictine monk before becoming a biblical scholar and writing a number of influential books. Johnson systematically skewers the Jesus Seminar, saying it by no means represents the cream of New Testament scholarship. It follows a process that is biased against the authenticity of the gospel traditions, and its results were already determined ahead of time. He concludes, "This is not responsible or even critical scholarship. It is a self-indulgent charade." He goes on to quote other distinguished scholars with similar opinions, including Dr. Howard Clark Key, who called the seminar an academic disgrace, and Richard Hayes of Duke University, whose review of the five Gospels asserted that
The case argued by this book would not stand up in any court. I closed the book and turned off the light. Tomorrow I'd resume my hunt for evidence that would stand up. Part 2. Analyzing Jesus. 7. The identity evidence. Was Jesus really convinced that he was the Son of God? John Douglas has an uncanny ability to look into the minds of people he has never met. As the original psychological profiler for the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Douglas would gather information at a crime scene and then use his insights to peer inside the personality of the still-at-large perpetrator. Case in point, Douglas predicted that the Trailside Killer, a serial murderer who stalked wooded areas near San Francisco from 1979 to 1981, would be someone who had a speech impediment as well as tendencies toward animal cruelty, bedwetting, and arson. Sure enough, the person finally arrested and convicted in the case fit those descriptions perfectly. With a doctorate in psychology, years of experience as a detective, and a natural talent for understanding human behavior, Douglas has become renowned for his profiling prowess. He has co-authored several bestsellers on the topic, and when Jodie Foster won the Oscar for her performance in Silence of the Lambs, she publicly thanked Douglas for being the real-life figure behind her character's FBI mentor. How is Douglas able to understand the thinking process of individuals he has never even talked to? Behavior reflects personality, Douglas explained to Biography magazine. In other words, Douglas closely examines the evidence left behind at the crime scene and, where possible, interviews victims to find out exactly what the criminal said and did. From these clues, the left-behind products of the person's behavior, he deduces the individual's psychological makeup. Now to Jesus. Without dialoguing with him, how can we possibly delve into his mind to determine what his motivations, intentions, and self-understanding were? How do we know who he thought he was and what he understood his mission to be? By looking at his behavior, Douglas would say. If we want to figure out whether Jesus thought he was the Messiah or Son of God, or merely considered himself to be a rabbi or prophet, we need to look at what he did, what he said, and how he related to others. The question of what Jesus thought about himself is a critical issue. Some professors maintain that the myth of Jesus' deity was superimposed on the Jesus tradition by overzealous supporters years after his death. The real Jesus, these professors believe, would roll over in his grave if he knew people were worshiping him. If you strip away the legends and go back to the earliest material about him, they say you'll find he never aspired to be anything more than an itinerant teacher and occasional rabble-rouser. But is the evidence of history on their side? To find out, I flew to Lexington, Kentucky, and drove the winding roads past a series of picturesque horse farms to track down the scholar whose acclaimed book, The Christology of Jesus, confronts this very subject. The sixth interview. Ben Witherington III, Ph.D. There isn't much to tiny Wilmore, Kentucky, except Asbury Theological Seminary, where I found Ben Witherington's office on the fourth floor of a colonial-style building off the rustic community's main drag. With the gracious hospitality of a southern gentleman, the North Carolina native offered me a comfortable chair and some coffee as we sat down to discuss who Jesus of Nazareth thought he was. The topic is familiar territory to Witherington, whose books include Jesus the Sage, The Many Faces of the Christ, The Jesus Quest, Jesus, Paul, and the End of the World, and Women in the Ministry of Jesus, and whose articles about Jesus have appeared in specialized dictionaries and academic journals. Educated at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary, Master of Divinity degree, summa cum laude, and the University of Durham in England, doctorate in theology with a concentration in New Testament, Witherington has taught at Asbury, Ashland Theological Seminary, the Divinity School of Duke University, and Gordon Conwell. His memberships include the Society for the Study of the New Testament,
the Society of Biblical Literature, and the Institute for Biblical Research. Speaking distinctly and deliberately, weighing his words with care, Witherington definitely sounded like a scholar, yet his voice betrayed an unmistakable undercurrent of fascination, even awe, for his subject. This attitude emerged even further when he took me on a tour of a high-tech studio where he had been mixing images of Jesus with songs whose lyrics illuminate the compassion, the sacrifice, the humanity, and the majesty of his life and ministry. For a scholar who writes heavily footnoted, cautiously nuanced, and academically precise prose on the technical issues involving Jesus, this artistic wedding of video and music is a poetic outlet for exploring the side of Jesus that only the creative arts can come close to capturing. Back in Witherington's office, I decided to begin examining the issue of Jesus' self-understanding with a question that often springs to the minds of readers when they're exposed to the Gospels for the first time. "The truth is that Jesus was a bit mysterious about his identity, wasn't he?" I asked as Witherington pulled up a chair across from me. "He tended to shy away from forthrightly proclaiming himself to be the Messiah or Son of God. Was that because he didn't think of himself in those terms, or because he had other reasons?" "No, it's not because he didn't think of himself in those terms," Witherington said as he settled into his chair and crossed his legs. "If he had simply announced, 'Hi, folks, I'm God,' that would have been heard as, 'I'm Yahweh,' because the Jews of his day didn't have any concept of the Trinity. They only knew of God the Father, whom they called Yahweh, and not God the Son or God the Holy Spirit. So if someone were to say he was God, that wouldn't have made any sense to them and would have been seen as clear-cut blasphemy, and it would have been counterproductive to Jesus in his efforts to get people to listen to his message. Besides, there were already a host of expectations about what the Messiah would look like, and Jesus didn't want to be pigeonholed into somebody else's categories. Consequently, he was very careful about what he said publicly. In private with his disciples, that was a different story, but the Gospels primarily tell us about what he did in public." Exploring the Earliest Traditions. It was a 1977 book by British theologian John Hick and half a dozen like-minded colleagues that prompted a firestorm of controversy by charging that Jesus never thought of himself as God incarnate or the Messiah. "These concepts," they wrote, "developed later and were written into the Gospels, so it appeared that Jesus was making these claims about himself." To explore that allegation, Witherington had gone back to the very earliest traditions about Jesus, the most primitive material, unquestionably safe from legendary development, and discovered persuasive clues concerning how Jesus really regarded himself. I wanted to delve into that research, starting with this question. What clues can we find about Jesus' self-understanding from the way he related to others? Witherington thought for a moment, then replied, "Look at his relationship with his disciples. Jesus has 12 disciples, yet notice that he's not one of the 12. "While that may sound like a detail without a difference, Witherington said it's quite significant. If the 12 represent a renewed Israel, where does Jesus fit in?" he asked. "He's not just part of Israel, not merely part of the redeemed group. He's forming the group, just as God in the Old Testament formed his people and set up the 12 tribes of Israel. That's a clue about what Jesus thought of himself." Witherington went on to describe a clue that can be found in Jesus' relationship with John the Baptist. Jesus says, "Of all people born of woman, John is the greatest man on earth." Having said that, he then goes even further in his ministry than the Baptist did, by doing miracles, for example. What does that say about what he thinks of himself? "And his relationship with the religious leaders is perhaps the most revealing. Jesus makes the truly radical statement that it's not what enters a person that defiles him, but what comes out of his heart. Frankly,
This sets aside huge portions of the Old Testament book of Leviticus with its meticulous rules concerning purity. Now, the Pharisees didn't like this message. They wanted to keep things as they were, but Jesus said, no, God has further plans. He's doing a new thing. We have to ask, what kind of person thinks he has the authority to set aside the divinely inspired Jewish scriptures and supplant them with his own teaching? And what about his relationship, if we can call it that, with the Roman authorities? We have to ask why they crucified him. If he had merely been an innocuous sage telling nice little parables, how did he end up on a cross, especially at a Passover season when no Jew wants any Jew to be executed? There had to be a reason why the sign above his head said, "This is the King of the Jews." Witherington let that last comment hang in the air before providing the explanation himself. Either Jesus had made that verbal claim, he said, or someone clearly thought he did. By the finger of God. While Jesus' relationships provide one window into his self-understanding, Witherington said that Jesus' deeds, especially his miracles, offer additional insights. However, I raised my hand to stop him. Certainly, you can't say that Jesus' miracles established that he thought he was God, I said, since later his own disciples went out and did the same things, and certainly they weren't making claims of deity. No, it's not the fact that Jesus did miracles that illuminates his self-understanding, replied Witherington. What's important is how he interprets his miracles. What do you mean? Jesus says, "If I, by the finger of God, cast out demons, then you will know that the kingdom of God has come upon you." He's not like other miracle workers who do amazing things and then life proceeds as it always has. No, to Jesus, his miracles are a sign indicating the coming of the kingdom of God. They are a foretaste of what the kingdom is going to be like, and that sets Jesus apart. Again, I interrupted. Elaborate on that a bit, I said. How does it set him apart? Jesus sees his miracles as bringing about something unprecedented, the coming of God's dominion, replied Witherington. He doesn't merely see himself as a worker of miracles. He sees himself as the one in whom and through whom the promises of God come to pass. And that's a not too thinly veiled claim of transcendence. I nodded. Now his point made sense to me. With that, I turned to the words of Jesus in search of more clues concerning his self-understanding. He was called Rabuni or Rabbi by his followers, I said. Doesn't this imply that he merely taught like the other rabbis of his day? Witherington grinned. Actually, he said, Jesus taught in a radical new way. He begins his teachings with the phrase, "Amen, I say to you," which is to say, "I swear in advance to the truthfulness of what I'm about to say." This was absolutely revolutionary. How so? In Judaism, you needed the testimony of two witnesses, so witness A could witness the truth of witness B and vice versa. But Jesus witnesses to the truth of his own sayings. Instead of basing his teaching on the authority of others, he speaks on his own authority. So here is someone who considered himself to have authority above and beyond what the Old Testament prophets had. He believed he possessed not only divine inspiration, as King David did, but also divine authority and the power of direct divine utterance. In addition to employing the Amen phrase in his teaching, Jesus used the term Abba when he was relating to God. What does that tell us about what he thought about himself, I asked. Well, Abba connotes intimacy in a relationship between a child and his father, Witherington explained. Interestingly, it's also the term disciples used for a beloved teacher in early Judaism. But Jesus used it of God, and as far as I can tell, he and his followers were the only ones praying to God that way. When I asked Witherington to expand on the importance of this, he said, "In the context in which Jesus operated, it was customary for Jews to work around having to say the name of God. His name was the most holy word you could speak, and they even feared mispronouncing it. If they were going to address God, they might say something like, 'The Holy One, blessed be He,' but they were not going to use His personal name." "And Abba is a personal term," I said. "Very personal. It's the term of endearment in which a child would say to a parent, 'Father, dearest, what would you have me do?'" However, I spotted an apparent inconsistency. "Wait a second," I interjected. "Praying Abba must not imply that Jesus thinks he's God, because he taught his disciples to use the same term in their own prayers, and they're not God." "Actually," came Witherington's reply, "the significance of Abba is that Jesus is the initiator of an intimate relationship that was previously unavailable. The question is, what kind of person can change the terms of relating to God? What kind of person can initiate a new covenantal relationship with God?" His distinction made sense to me. "So, how significant do you consider Jesus' use of Abba to be?" I asked. "Quite significant," he answered. "It implies that Jesus had a degree of intimacy with God that is unlike anything in the Judaism of his day. And listen, here's the kicker. Jesus is saying that only through having a relationship with him does this kind of prayer language, this kind of Abba relationship with God, become possible. That says volumes about how he regarded himself." Witherington started to add another important clue. Jesus repeated reference to himself as the Son of Man. But I let him know that a previous expert, Craig Blomberg, had already explained that this was a reference to Daniel 7. This term, Witherington agreed, is extremely important in revealing Jesus' messianic or transcendent self-understanding. At this point, I paused to take stock of what Witherington had said. When I put together the clues from Jesus' relationships, miracles, and words, his perception of his identity came into sharp focus. There seemed little question, based upon the earliest evidence, that Jesus considered himself to be more than a doer of great deeds, more than a teacher, more than another prophet in a line of many. There was ample evidence to conclude that he thought of himself in unique and supreme terms. But exactly how sweeping was this self-understanding? John's portrait of Jesus. In its opening scene, the Gospel of John uses majestic and unambiguous language to boldly assert the deity of Jesus. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." John 1:1-3, 14. I remember reading that regal introduction when I went through the Gospel of John for the first time. I recall asking myself, I wonder how Jesus would respond if he were to read John's words about him. Would he recoil and say, "Whoa, John has got me all wrong. He has embellished and mythologized me to the point where I don't even recognize myself." Or would he nod approvingly and say, "Yep, I'm all that and more"? Later, I encountered the words of scholar Raymond Brown, who had come to his own conclusion. "I have no difficulty with the thesis that if Jesus could have read John, he would have found that gospel a suitable expression of his identity." Now here was my chance to hear directly from Witherington, who has spent a lifetime analyzing the scholarly minutiae concerning Jesus' self-perception, about whether he agrees with Brown's assessment. There was no hesitation and no equivocation. "Yes, I do," he said. "I don't have a problem with that. When you're dealing with the Gospel of John, you're dealing with a somewhat interpreted picture of Jesus, but I also believe it's a logical drawing out of what was implicit in the historical Jesus. And I'll add this. even if you eliminate the Gospel of John, there's still no non-messianic Jesus to be conjured up out of the material in the other three Gospels. It's just not there. Immediately I thought of the famous exchange, recorded in Matthew, in which Jesus asked his disciples in a private meeting, "Who do you say I am?" Peter replied with clarity, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Instead of ducking the issue, Jesus affirmed Peter for his observation. "Blessed are you," he said, "for this was not revealed to you by man, but by my Father in heaven." See Matthew 16:15-17. Even so, some popular depictions of Jesus, such as in the movie The Last Temptation of Christ, show him as basically uncertain about his identity and mission. He's saddled with ambiguity and angst. "Is there any evidence," I asked Witherington, "that Jesus ever had an identity crisis?" "Not an identity crisis, although I do believe he had points of identity confirmation," the professor replied. "At his baptism, at his temptation, at the Transfiguration, in the Garden of Gethsemane, these are crisis moments in which God confirmed to him who he was and what his mission was. For instance, I don't think it's accidental that his ministry does not begin in earnest until after his baptism, when he hears the voice saying, 'You are my Son, with whom I am well pleased.'" What did he think his mission was? He saw his job as coming to free the people of God, so his mission was directed to Israel. Specifically, to Israel. "Yes, that's correct," Witherington said. "There's very little evidence that he sought out Gentiles during his ministry. That was a mission for the later church. You see, the promises of the prophets had come to Israel, and to Israel he must go." I and the Father are one. In his book, Reasonable Faith, William Lane Craig points to a substantial amount of evidence that within 20 years of the crucifixion, there was a full-blown Christology proclaiming Jesus as God incarnate. Church historian Jaroslav Pelikan has pointed out that the oldest Christian sermon, the oldest account of a Christian martyr, the oldest pagan report of the church, and the oldest liturgical prayer, 1 Corinthians 16:22, all refer to Jesus as Lord and God. Pelikan said, "Clearly it was the message of what the church believed and taught that God was an appropriate name for Jesus Christ." In light of this, I asked Witherington, "Do you see any possible way this could have developed, especially so soon, if Jesus had never made transcendent and messianic claims about himself?" Witherington was adamant. "Not unless you're prepared to argue that the disciples completely forgot what the historical Jesus was like, and that they had nothing to do with the traditions that start showing up 20 years after his death. Frankly, as an historian, this would not make any sense at all." In dealing with history, he added, "all sorts of things are possible, but not all possible things are equally probable." "Is it probable," he asked, "that all this stuff was conjured up out of thin air within 20 years after Jesus died, when there were still living witnesses to what Jesus, the historical figure, was really like? I find that just about as unlikely an historical hypothesis as you could possibly come up with. The real issue is, what happened after the crucifixion of Jesus that changed the minds of the disciples who had denied, disobeyed, and deserted Jesus? Very simply, something happened to them that was similar to what Jesus experienced at his baptism. It was confirmed to them that what they had hoped Jesus was, he was."
This concludes this disc. Please proceed to Disc 6 for the continuation of the program.